the slander. Still, I couldn't stop being me. What's the saying? I'd rather be hated for who I am than loved for who I'm not? That became the mantra I'd repeat in my head every weekday between 2 and 7 as Wendy would unleash her army of haters on me. The turning point came one weekend when I was down in South Carolina trying to make some extra bread hosting parties. I was hanging out with an old man I befriended named Ronald Ferguson. He was a talented artist who I met after I commissioned him to paint a big-ass portrait of my girl. Ronald reminded me of Rafiki from The Lion King. From the outside, he seemed batshit crazy, but he was actually a wise dude. Ronald used to listen to me on Wendy, and when we'd hang out, I'd talk to him about what was happening on the show. That one weekend, I was sitting in his yard as he painted, and I was being unusually silent. I was preoccupied with how much hate I was getting from Wendy's listeners. I thought New Yorkers out of everyone would appreciate my honesty. If New Yorkers who prided themselves on keeping it real weren't going to support me, would anyone? Was I already at the end of the road? Ronald must have been reading my mind because out of nowhere he said to me, "You know you're going to win up there, right?" "Huh?" I replied. "In New York," he said. "They don't like you now, but that's only because they don't know you yet. Just keep being honest. Keep being yourself, and you're going to be all right." It wasn't a long speech. I don't think Ronald even looked up from his canvas as he spoke, but that simple advice was exactly what I needed to hear. I took his words back to New York with me that Monday and doubled down on being myself. I couldn't just tell the truth about how I felt about the industry. I had to start telling the truth more about myself, too. So I told the listeners about how I was having a hard time making the transition to New York, how lonely it was to be up here without friends or a place of my own, how I felt like a fish out of water, struggling to figure out how to catch a bus or ride the subway, how discouraging it was to go on Wendy's site and read that most of them wanted to send me packing. Opening up was the turning point. Instead of dissing me, they began to root for me. They wanted to walk my journey with me. As an added bonus, after hearing how lost and lonely I was, a lot of women felt like it was their duty to take care of me because I was a long way from home. I can't even begin to tell you how much sympathy, pussy, and free meals I got during this time. I learned the esophagus of a woman with empathy for your situation is a perfect place for your penis. Slowly but surely, the tide started to change. The barriers started to be broken down. The "I hate Charlamagne" comment started to turn into "I hate Charlamagne, but that was some real shit he said." And from that point, I was good. But only because I listened to Ronald and didn't try to be anything but my true, authentic self. Standing by your words. Birdman wasn't the only artist whose feathers got ruffled by my refusal to pander to the industry. Since landing on The Breakfast Club, I've dubbed myself the Prime Minister of pissing people off, the architect of aggravation, and the ruler of rubbing people the wrong way, for my penchant for getting under artist skin. Over the years, there have been dozens of rappers, singers, actors, and even moguls who've been pissed off by my unfiltered opinions. One time, P. Diddy didn't appreciate my assessment of Last Train to Paris, the album he made with his female group Dirty Money. In addition to calling it garbage, I described it as shake weight music and said it was made for men to rub each other's calf muscles to. Remember when everyone thought the NBA star Chris Bosh was gay? I joked that Bosh probably liked listening to Last Train in his headphones while he warmed up for games. Sure enough, that night, ring, ring, Diddy on line one. Ever the salesman, Diddy tried to get me to change my opinion on the album. It wasn't hip-hop, it was dance music, he explained. I should appreciate it as such. Finally, Diddy told me, "You are gonna get on this train, one way or another." It was a good line, but I still wasn't buying a ticket, so I had to tell Diddy my original review still stood. Trash. To be fair, I was far from the only one with that opinion. Last Train ended up derailing not long after leaving the station, and we haven't heard anything from Dirty Money, a.k.a. the new total, since. Sometimes the complaints don't arrive in the form of a civilized phone conversation like I had with Diddy. Often they come during uncomfortable face-to-face encounters, when I see an artist at an event, award show, or party. I feel like these kind of encounters happen to me more than most. One reason is because I don't roll with a lot of security, just wax, though that's really more than enough. Maybe people feel like I'm an easy target, especially after watching Can I Get a Drop? The second reason is that when artists see me, I somehow become the manifestation of everything negative that's been said about them. Not just the comment I might have said on the radio, but what other jocks have said about them too, or slander they've read about themselves on social media. All that negativity rises to the surface when I enter the room. They work themselves into a frenzy and want to take action. I embrace that energy because I take pride in standing behind whatever I might have said on The Breakfast Club, The Brilliant Idiots podcast, social media, or my TV show Uncommon Sense. If I don't stand by my words in person, then it's cowardly for me to talk tough on the radio. It's an important policy to have, but it admittedly leads to some tense situations. A prime example is when the former Bad Boy star Mace tried to roll on me at the Revolt Music Conference in Miami a few years back. He was upset because I had been very vocal in my opinion that he was a hypocrite. Here's why. Just a few years after being one of the hottest rappers in the country, Mace retired from rap to dedicate himself to serving God. He wrote a book about his new life and started preaching at a church in Atlanta. He must have gotten bored with that life because a few years after that, he started hanging around rappers again and divorced his wife. Most of his congregation got fed up and he left the church. So May said, fuck it, and became a rapper again. Not a Christian rapper either. He signed with the gangster rap god 50 Cent. Look, everybody is entitled to change their mind, but I couldn't understand how you go overnight from being a man of the cloth to a G-Unit soldier. I expressed this opinion on several occasions, but hadn't been in the same room with him until the conference. I was waiting to be seated at a restaurant at the Fontaine Blue Hotel when out of nowhere, Mace walked up on me and said, "What's up?" in a way that insinuated the next thing coming from him was going to be a punch. "What's up?" I replied back to him in the same tone, which he didn't appreciate. He started to aggressively move forward, but he clearly didn't see my brother from another Wax standing right behind me. Before I could even respond, Wax was already manhandling Mace and threw him clean out the restaurant. It's situations like that where I have to be smart. When you have a weapon of mass destruction like Wax at your disposal, you can't misuse it. As much as I would have liked to teach Mace a lesson for rolling up on me like that, it wasn't worth it. There was absolutely no reason to demolish a way past his prime rapper turned preacher turned rapper again at the Revolt Music Conference. It would be pointless. So I told Wax to fall back from Mace, who, of course, had changed his tune. "I just want to talk. I just want to talk," he kept saying while keeping one eye on Wax. Just in case you think I'm exaggerating, ESPN commentator Bomani Jones happened to be eating in the restaurant at the time and witnessed the whole thing between Wax and Mace. This is how Bomani, who didn't have a dog in the fight, described it on his podcast. Mace walks in, and he just gets a couple steps in, toward me, by the way. And next thing I know, Mace is on the retreat. And some big dude in a white T-shirt and tight camouflage, tight pants and Timberlands is coming back the other way. The gentleman wearing Timberlands at the Fontaine Blue has Mace on the retreat. Now, obviously, this was a music industry event. But I also feel like if you're in a tropical environment and you got a dude walking around in boots, he's ready. Eventually, things cooled down a bit. And Mace and I went to a corner of the restaurant to talk. He told me why he didn't like being called a hypocrite. He was really upset because he felt like I was behind a conspiracy to blackball him from New York radio. Huh? I told him straight up that that was nonsense, and the reason he wasn't getting played on the radio anymore was A, it wasn't the 90s anymore, and B, people had lost respect for him. You can't go from rap to the church, back to rap, back to church like that, I told him. It's not believable. The exact same thing I had been saying on the radio. All he could do was give me dap and say, "I respect that." If I had backpedaled or tried to distance myself from what I said on the radio, Mace wouldn't have respected me, and I wouldn't have respected myself. You have to stand by your words. That's the only way they can hold weight. Mace and I still don't like each other, but at least we know where the other person stands. Busta Rhymes is another artist who decided to take out his frustrations on me in public. I forget the year, but the day was definitely June 29th, which is my born day. I was in L.A. drunk as hell at Melanie Fiona's birthday party. She's a Cancer, too. I was celebrating with Angela Yee, our homegirl L'Oreal, and, of course, Wax. At one point, we were chopping it up with my dude, Boo. That's Akon's brother. When Busta Rhymes walked into our section, I could feel him looking at me, but it was my birthday, and I was in a good mood, so I didn't sweat it. Then Busta approached and said he needed to have a few words with yours truly. "Do you know me?" he asked. "What?" I replied. "Do you know me?" Busta said again. I was pretty drunk, so my tolerance for BS was running on empty. Of course I knew him. Busta was one of the greatest live performers in the history of hip-hop, a living legend, so that clearly wasn't what he was really asking. He was trying to punk me, probably because I had spoken several times on the radio about how I felt Busta had fallen off musically. I'd even wrote on Twitter, "You put the TV on mute while Busta is performing?" The closed captions would just be a bunch of exclamation marks and question marks. "Yeah, I know who you are. You're a rapper I used to like," I told him, "but your shit is whack now." That set him off. Buster started ranting about how I tried to sabotage his situation with his baby mama when she was on Wendy's show, how I tried to turn her against him. He was passionate about what he was saying, but there was one slight problem. The interview he was referring to happened 3 years before I was on Wendy's show. Buster, I have no idea what you're talking about, I told him, in all honesty. He thought I was just trying to play dumb. You Charlamagne, right? He shot back. I was getting tired of the game. I was not on Wendy's show when your baby mama was there, I said, adding, plus, if you don't know who I am, then why are you complaining about something I allegedly said? That must not have been the answer he was looking for, because then he turned into the rah, rah, like a dungeon dragon he used to rap about. You better stop all this tough guy shit, he roared. You better stop this tough guy shit. We can get it on in this restaurant, I told him, perhaps foolishly. Buster's security guard stepped up like he was going to do something, but Wax appeared out of nowhere and sternly announced, I'll fuck you up. That stopped Buster's guy dead in his tracks. Just as things seemed like they were going to get physical, Boo and my man Dennis Ortiz, Joel Ortiz's brother, stepped between us and calmed things down. I'm glad they did because, truthfully, testosterone, ego, and liquor were fueling that situation, and there was no need for us to fight. And for the record, I got no issues with Buster now. We give each other a mutual peace when we see each other. Truthfully, I don't know if I could beat Busta Rhymes in a fight if things had gotten to that point. If you look at pictures of the confrontation, I look like a lap dog barking at a pit bull, but I also didn't care. I've had my ass kicked a few times. I'm not afraid to lose a fight. To me, it was about the principle of standing next to my words. I could take a stand for saying he's becoming a whack-ass rapper, but I couldn't stand by the baby mama beef because I'd had nothing to do with it. You have to be able to stand by your words at all times. If you don't, then they don't mean anything. The danger of yes men. Another reason honesty is so hard to find in hip-hop comes down to the bedbugs of the industry, the yes men. It feels like you never see one, but these guys and girls are everywhere. The reason it seems like you never see them is because no one wants to own up to the job. You won't find anyone whose job description is being a rapper's yes man. But trust me, the vast majority of the rappers I know have one, if not several. I believe one of the reasons Kanye has been so emotional about his career is because he feels like he doesn't have anyone keeping it real with him. When I hear Kanye rant, I hear someone searching for truth. Someone hoping at least one person will give him an honest opinion. Instead of honesty, I suspect Kanye only gets validation. When he taped his Kanye Kardashian interview at the Breakfast Club, he had the usual horde of handlers, label publicists, management company people, and security. He also had two dudes with him who were dressed fresh to death, at least by Kanye's standards, because I don't know what the hell they were wearing. Maybe they were his stylists. Someone who was there later told me that while we were interviewing Kanye in the studio, those two dudes were in the lobby, which also serves as our green room. The studio has big glass windows, so you can watch the interview from the lobby. Throughout the interview, those guys stood there watching. Every time Kanye made a point, they'd get animated. Maybe give him a fist pump or cheer him on. He kept looking at them throughout the interview and seemed to feed off their energy. Nothing wrong with that, right? They were just being supportive. Now, here's the thing. The audio from the interview isn't piped into the lobby. That means they literally couldn't hear what he was saying. They were just giving him positive affirmation because they saw that as their job. He could have been crashing and burning during that interview, and they'd still be cheering him on like he just dropped the greatest gem in the world. The people who were in the lobby with them later told me it was surreal, the very epitome of yes men. After the interview, when we walked out together, the first thing he told those guys was, Charlamagne told me ain't none of y'all keep it real with me. Kanye knew that I'd at least told him the truth. I heard after he left our studio, he went over the tape with my buddy Elvis Duran as Z100. And kept shaking his head and zoning out during the pre-interview. When Garrett, one of the producers, asked him if everything was okay, he said, yo, my bad. I just got finished talking with Charlamagne. When all you've been getting is pre-approved validation, hearing the hard truth can mess your head up. I'm sure that's how Kanye felt. All the more reason he needed to hear it. If the people closest to you won't be real with you, how else can you improve? How else can you push yourself? How else will you know when you're playing yourself? I practice what I preach in this department. If you listen to me on any of my platforms, you know that not only am I honest with my co-hosts and the people around me, but I also demand the same honesty in return. A lot of folks are shocked when they listen to The Brilliant Idiots because of how hard Andrew Schultz and I go at each other when we get into a heated debate. I'll see comments like, I can't believe Charlamagne doesn't punch Schultz in the mouth. Son is mad disrespectful. Or Charlamagne needs to let that white boy go, always disagreeing with him. Why would I get rid of Andrew for disagreeing with me? That's what I want, and what the listeners should want from a co-host. It's so much healthier than a co-host just saying, yep, or no doubt, every time I make a point. It's no different with Wax. If he is doing something foolish, which admittedly is often, I'll let him know in no uncertain terms I've gotten on his case both on and off air many times. But if I respect something he's working on, like opening a chicken farm in South Carolina, I'll publicly give him props as well as supporting him behind the scenes. All my friendships are built on a similar foundation of honesty. I don't want any yes men around me. I want everybody to tell me the truth, even if it costs them their job. Samuel Goldwyn. Here's the thing. Everyone says they don't want yes men around. Everyone says they want their people to keep it real with them. In reality, however, very few people do. For all their talk about, my team always gives it to me straight, they don't actually want that at all. They're much more comfortable dodging the truth than facing it head on. Are you one of those people? When one of your close friends, family members, or crew give you a little constructive criticism, how do you react? Do you get defensive? Are you dismissive? Or even worse, do you lash out at that person? If the answer to any of those questions is yes, then your actions are discouraging honesty and encouraging yes men. When you dismiss or lash out at a person who keeps it real with you, what do you think eventually happens? They stop keeping it real. They might not lie to you, but they'll probably just keep their mouth shut when they see you screwing up. They'll sit there and watch as you self-destruct. Can you really blame them? They tried to help you, but you weren't receptive. This is why it's so important to empower your inner circle. Get your ego in check and listen when they slander you. Instead of pushing an honest friend away, bring him or her even closer into your decision-making process. Sure, it hurts to be criticized at first, especially by people close to you, but you'll get over that little sting. Remember, yes men aren't only unproductive, they can get you killed, figuratively and literally. You know what happens when you have nothing but yes men in your corner? You eventually get knocked the fuck out. Honesty in your relationship. Sure, you want your team, your squad, your people, your folk, your crew, your clan, your niggas, whatever you want to call them, to be honest with you and vice versa. But the person you really need to be brutally honest with is your significant other. Your boo, your old lady, your old man, the person you are sharing bodily fluids with on a consistent basis, the person you go to sleep with at night. Whatever you call him or her, you'd better be all the way honest with them if you want your relationship to truly flourish. Again, I have largely practiced what I preach on this subject to a degree that might shock you. I'm convinced the only reason Mook Mook and I are happily married today is because of raw, brutal, and ultimately beautiful honesty we've shared with each other over the years. We've been together off and on since we were 16 years old. We literally grew up together. We've gone through so much it would be pointless for us to lie to each other. No matter what bullshit we have done, honesty has been the glue that's kept us together. I've done a lot of dirt over the years, but perhaps my lowest moment took place at Mook Mook senior prom. In Monk's Corner, the tradition was that after the prom, all the kids would head down to Myrtle Beach and hang out for the weekend. That year, Mook Mook went with her crew, her cousin Trika and her best friend Uquinta, while I brought along my cousin Anthony. We were all at the hotel getting wasted. I'm talking that kind of dangerous rock star wasted. The girls were having a great time listening to music and cracking jokes, but Anthony and I were thinking like savages. Back then, our mindset was, have sex with everything. Yep, I'd come with my girl, but we wanted to fuck the whole crew. It's not a good excuse, but back in those days, we didn't have much else going on in our lives. The more fly chicks you could smash in Mom's Corner, the more badges of honor you could strut around town with. That's all that mattered to us. So even though Anthony had his girlfriend with him and I had mine, we hatched a scumbag scheme to get with Trika and Uquinta. Somehow, we convinced our girlfriends to go back to their room. Then we crept off to the room Trika and Uquinta were sharing. One thing led to another, and I started having sex with Trika. If that wasn't bad enough, after a while, Anthony and I switched up, and I ended up getting with Uquinta, too. No need to tell me I was a complete piece of shit, I already know. After my dirty deeds, I went back to Mook Mook's hotel and acted like everything was good. The next day, we all headed back to Monk's Corner, and it seemed like she was none the wiser for what had happened. Then a couple days later, Trika and Uquinta showed up at Mook Mook's house. Uquinta, with her fake God-fearing ass, declared she needed to get something off her chest. God wants me to let you know something, she told Mook Mook dramatically before turning to Treacle. Go ahead, tell her, Treacle. Then Treacle tearfully confessed, I had sex with Larry over the weekend in Myrtle Beach. Mook Mook immediately called me and said, Larry, is there something you want to tell me? Like what, I asked. Like you and Treacle having sex after the prom, because that's what you Quinta just told me. I didn't freak out or start weaving a bunch of lies together. Actually, I was pissed off, because if you're going to tell the truth in God's name, then you'd better tell the whole truth, which you Quinta evidently had neglected to do. Word? That's what you Quinta told you, I calmly replied. You know what? She's right. I did fuck Treacle, but I fucked you Quinta too. Did she tell you that? Mook Mook was still furious with me, but I believe she was more pissed that you Quinta had come over there with a holier-than-thou attitude and tried to palm the whole thing off on Treacle. I guess God didn't tell her to own up to her own dirt. Even after I told my girl the truth, you Quinta still denied it, but as I pointed out, why in the hell would I confess to more crimes if I didn't have to? Yes, I was a scumbag, but I was an honest scumbag. That doesn't absolve me, but I do think it's better that somebody be with me knowing exactly what I am than be with me for what they think I am. I believe I was only able to salvage our relationship and build it into the place it is today by being honest. It's easier to forgive somebody when they tell the truth about a situation, especially in a relationship. Mook Mook might not have trusted me when it comes to other women, but she could trust me as a person. Now, I'm not telling y'all to cheat and didn't tell your significant other the truth and expect everything will be okay. If you cheat, chances are your relationship isn't going to work out too well, but I'm telling you, your odds improve if you are honest. Not only about what you did, but why you did it too. And just to be clear, the primary reason Mook Mook even gave me a second chance was because we were both young and still relatively stupid. No way she would put up with that sort of shit now. And to be fair, I wasn't the only one who has done dirt in this relationship. Most women go through their whole phase in college, as I believe they should, and Mook Mook definitely cheated on me when she attended the University of South Carolina. Calling it cheating might be a little harsh because, as I said, the truth is we were on and off for many years until we finally got engaged. Since honesty has always been at the root of our relationship, she told me all about it, too. When a woman drops that atomic bomb, almost all men turn into a complete shell of themselves. I was no exception. Like an idiot, I didn't just accept that information and keep it moving. No, like so many other clueless men before and since, I started to ask questions, especially about one dude that she seemed to have had a thing for. Was he better than me in bed, I queried. He wasn't necessarily better, she said. I took the bait. Was he bigger than me? Silence. What? He was big, I yelled. How much? Yo, I ain't never seen no shit like that before, she confessed. My mouth went dry. I got lightheaded. I had an anxiety attack. I felt like one of those guys who passes out in the courtroom after getting hit with a long-ass prison sentence. I really didn't know dicks that big existed, she continued. The way it was just hanging there, I couldn't believe it. The conversation was getting too real. The kind of moment when being in a relationship with your best friend backfires. I wasn't even thinking straight at that point, so another dumbass question spilled out of my gaping mouth. Well, were you at least taking it, I asked. I did not want to imagine her screaming and making faces while she's getting dicked down by this freak of nature. I hope you weren't flinching or nothing. Hell no, she replied. Not at all. I handled it. Good, I reassured myself. At least she took that dick like a champ and he didn't make her scream. The conversation left me a little uptight about my penis size for a time. Previously, I'd always assumed I had a big dick by the reactions I'd gotten, but after what Mook Mook told me about her college homeboy, I wasn't so sure anymore. I started looking at all the penis enhancement products on the back pages of The Source and XXL. I ended up ordering something called Magna RX pills, which promised it would enlarge my dick in 60 days. In addition to the pills, they also had me do a daily exercise where you grab the tip of your penis and basically tried to stretch it out. I took the pills and faithfully did my penis pulls, but nothing really happened. For better or worse, I was stuck on 7 3/4 inches in the fall winter months and 8 inches during warm seasons. Now, before I move on, I can still hear some of you out there sucking your teeth about that prom story. The hell with that. There's no way I'm taking any man back after he sleeps with my best friend and my cousin. Some of you fellas might be saying, forget that. I'm not taking my girl back after she cheats on me with a dude with a shack-sized dick. And in theory, I agree. Nobody should feel like they have to put up with infidelity. I would argue, however, that a lot of us have hurt people we love, especially when we were young. A lot of us have done some incredibly stupid and selfish things as part of our growing pains, or in the case of wild sexual escapades, growing pleasures. I was one of those young men, but Mook Mook and I were friends, or more like family, to tell you the truth. And you don't just cut your family off. Yeah, we did a lot of stupid stuff, but clearly there was something else there, too, which was deeper than whatever I did prom weekend or whatever she did in college. I can't promise being brutally honest after you mess up will work for you. I can only tell you what worked for me. Mook Mook and I are happily married with 2 kids, and I love her more now than I did back then. I treat her like a queen because I still feel bad for all the drama I put her through. The only acceptable apology I can give her is truly changed behavior, and I am a completely different individual now than I was 15 years ago. I don't want to hurt my wife the way I saw my dad hurt my mom. It's really that simple. In a romantic relationship, it's always better to deal with reality than fantasy. I'm not going to sell a dream to my wife. I would rather live the dream with her, and that only happens when the relationship is rooted in honesty. Principle 7, give people the credit they deserve for being stupid. Knowledge is infinite. That means there's no limit to what you can learn. So if you think you're the smartest person in the room, then you clearly have been in that room and around the same people for far too long. You must always stay open and receptive to new information via friends, family, coaches, elders, and experiences. You must give people the credit they deserve for being stupid, starting with yourself. Lord knows I do. I'm happy to tell you that I don't know shit. I got kicked out of 2 high schools. I barely graduated from night school. My higher education consisted of half a day at a technical institute. I can't quote the U.S. Constitution, name the capitals of more than a handful of states, tell you who the U.S. presidents were, recite Shakespeare, or explain the laws of physics. There's a reason I named my podcast The Brilliant Idiots. But here's the thing. I'm extremely comfortable with my lack of formal education. It's my secret weapon. Waking up every morning knowing that I'm ignorant is what motivates me to keep learning. Do you know what does make someone stupid? Being unwilling to learn. Being closed off to absorbing new information. That's why I'm never going to be uptight about not knowing something. Here's an example. When the Dominican-American actress Dasha Polanco of Orange is the New Black came on The Breakfast Club, she mentioned she identified as an Afro-Latino. What's that? I asked her in all sincerity. Dasha explained that it referred to a Latino with African roots, but man, you would have thought I just said I didn't know who America fought in the Revolutionary War. Folks jumped all over me for supposedly being ignorant and uninformed. Latina.com ran a story with the headline, Dasha Polanco School Charlemagne on what it means to be Afro-Latina, while Jezebel's headline announced, Dasha Polanco is forced to explain the existence of Afro-Latinas to Charlemagne. The implication was I should have been embarrassed by not being familiar with the term, but why? I'm from South Carolina, where not too many people go around identifying themselves as Afro-Latinas, simply because there aren't that many Dominicans or Puerto Ricans down there. Does that make me an idiot for not knowing the term? I don't think so. To put it in context, could Dasha make the distinction between being a freshwater Geechee or a saltwater Geechee? It's actually pretty self-explanatory. Freshwater Geechee live inland, and saltwater Geechee live closer to the coast. Probably not, since there aren't many Geechees in Brooklyn. Does that make her an idiot? Of course not. It just shows that the two of us have had different experiences and been around different kinds of people. I wasn't familiar with her kind of background, and by asking that question, I got educated. I'll never feel bad about doing that. One of the many things I love about my 8-year-old daughter is that she reminds me why it's so important to keep asking questions. Yes, it can get a tad annoying after the 500th question of the day, but you still don't ever want kids to lose their inquisitive instinct. Asking questions is what helps them evolve. It's what teaches them how to avoid danger. It's what helps them make sense of their place in the world. It's what inspires them to dream. Unfortunately, as we grow older, we tend to lose that childlike curiosity. Instead of asking questions when we don't know something, which still happens every day, we keep our mouth shut. Instead of pestering our elders to explain the many things we don't understand, we try to act like we know as much as they do, if not more. As a result, our evolution slows down to a crawl. We get set in our ways. We think we have all the answers and stop asking questions. Then one day, we look up and can't understand why we haven't progressed as far as we wanted to in life. Why we seem stuck in a rut while other people continue to get further and further ahead. The answer is simple. If you're not evolving, then you're regressing. There's no middle ground. This is why it's no coincidence that every successful adult I know has a thirst for knowledge that rivals my 8-year-old daughter's. They might not ask as many questions verbally, but they share the same energy. They are constantly trying to soak up new information, new ideas, and new approaches. It's like they're in a constant state of evolution. No matter how many records they've sold, how much money they've made, or houses they've bought, truly successful people are always looking to find out more. You are getting better, or you are getting worse. You never stay the same. That's a banner that's hanging up at the San Francisco 49ers practice facility. I just heard about how Bob Pittman, the CEO of iHeartRadio and one of the most important people in media, went to Burning Man Festival out in the Nevada desert. That means it's likely he didn't shower for a week and was so covered in dust he looked like an extra from Mad Max. He's also 60 years old and a multimillionaire, maybe even a billionaire. There are more luxurious ways he could be spending a long weekend, so why was he out there living like a 20-something-year-old raver? Because he knows there are a lot of unique people at Burning Man. He knows the festival is where interesting minds congregate. He knows that if he walks around for a week talking to eclectic people, he's going to come home with some new ideas, different kinds of inspiration than he would get spending a weekend with rich white people on a yacht. Bob understands that despite running iHeart, despite co-founding MTV and being its most successful president, it's critical that he still stay open to new ideas. That childlike inquisitiveness is exactly what has allowed him to remain a player all these years. It's important to remain open in your relationship with the world. They say that closed mouths don't get fed. Well, the same is true for minds. This is why you must stay open to making new friends, open to who you work with, open to criticism, open to changing your mind, and open to changing your relationships. Because when you close off your mind to those opportunities, you are also closing the door on your ability to get the most out of life. Yes, new friends. No new friends, no new friends, no new friends, no new. Still here with my day one niggas. No new friends, DJ Khaled and Drake. You remember that song? Did you like it? Well, I absolutely hated it when it dropped. Don't get me wrong, Drake, Rick Ross, and Lil Wayne all got busy. What I couldn't stand was the song's message. Avoid making new friends at all costs. Listen, I know what Drake and Khaled were trying to say. The more money and fame you get, the more opportunistic people will try to infiltrate your inner circle. There's certainly a lot of truth to that. But I still don't think a fear of fake people should color how you see the world. That's why I'd get bummed when No New Friends was trending on Twitter. Every time I saw that, I knew someone was unwittingly blocking themselves from so many potential blessings. Plus, the only day one friend you truly have is your goddamn mama. And your pops, if he's not a deadbeat. I've done pretty well for myself over the years, and I'm certainly not afraid of making new friends. If anything, I can say that 95% of what I've achieved in my career is due to the new friends I've made along the way. There's my homegirl, Devi Dev, who I became friends with while I was Wendy's sidekick. Back then, Devi was working at K-Day in Los Angeles, where she became my literal angel in the city of angels. There were several times when I landed an audition, I had a meeting with an agent, and Dev helped out by letting me crash at her pad. Once, she had a bunch of roommates who clearly didn't appreciate me sleeping on their couch, but Dev still insisted on putting me up. Not to mention, Dev had several beautiful interns over the years who I had the pleasure of having sex with. Yes, I'm a creep. Dev has done so much to support me over the years, I can't imagine I would have made it this far without her help. But suppose I had a no new friends policy when I first met Dev. Remember, I was broadcasting with Wendy at the time. I was being syndicated around the country, including on K-Day, the Heritage station in L.A. I was probably being heard by more people in Dev's market than she was. I could have easily said to myself, who is this chick? She's just sweating me because I'm hot right now. I'm not messing with her. Think of the friendship I would have missed out on. A friendship that remains to this day, I'll add, if I thought that way. Think of the positive affirmation I wouldn't have gotten when I needed it most. And most important, think of all the beautiful young interns I wouldn't have gone to bed with if I told myself no new friends when it came to Dev. For the record, Dev had no idea I was fucking her intern, so don't blame her. Bobby Bones is another great example. I met Bobby about 4 years ago at the iHeartRadio Music Festival. On the surface, We didn't seem to have much in common. I'm a black guy doing hip-hop radio. He's a white guy doing country. It would have been very easy for us to have shook hands, made some small talk, and then kept it moving. Yet, even in just a few minutes of conversation, on a human level, I could tell Bobby and I had a lot in common. I came to find out that, like me, Bobby had grown up southern and poor. Like me, he was considered a bit of a bad boy in radio. And like me, he'd even been physically attacked outside of a radio station and had to run for his life. We became new friends. And let me tell you, the relationship has paid off for me. Literally. Bobby has been incredibly helpful in helping me navigate the world of syndicated radio. Once the Breakfast Club got put on in dozens of markets, I had to start asking questions like, how do I renegotiate a syndicated contract? How much do I deserve to get paid? Only a handful of jocks ever get syndicated in their careers, so it's not like I'm constantly bumping into peers who can share that information with me. Luckily, my new friend Bobby knew the terrain. So when it was time for me to renegotiate my first really big contract, Bobby was happy to walk me through the process. He told me which questions to ask, what clauses were worth fighting for, and which weren't. He even connected me with a great agent, Paul Anderson. Far from costing me, my new friend Bobby probably helped me get more money than I would have on my own. I'm not suggesting you get rid of all your day ones or shouldn't go to them when you need someone to talk to. It's great to keep the connection with the people you grew up with, who you share memories with, and who understand where you come from. But in order for them to remain relevant in your life today, they need to be evolving at the same pace as you are, if not faster. Because if a person is stuck in the same place mentally where they were when you were kids, then that's not someone you should still look to for meaningful advice. That might sound harsh, but I've seen too many people who have failed to reach their potential because they've been too loyal to their day ones. Look, if you see those day ones when you're around the way, by all means, get them a pound. Ask them about their folks or how their sister is doing. Grab a drink with them and spend an hour laughing about all the BS y'all used to do. Then keep it moving. Unless they've demonstrated that they're evolving, do not rely on them for inspiration. Do not use them as a sounding board when you're trying to make an important decision. If they're still stuck in the same place where they were 10 or 15 years ago, they'll never point you in the right direction. You can tell if your friends are evolving at the proper pace by the type of conversation you have. For instance, when you and your boys get together, what sort of heated discussions do you get into? Debating who are the top five MCs of all time? For the record, I don't have a top five. I do, however, have a top seven. In no particular order, Killer Mike, Ghostface Killah, Jay-Z, Scarface, Nas, Jeezy, and T.I. Arguing whether Jordan would have been better than LeBron if he played today? Whether Shotters was better than Belly? If you find yourself having those same old tired conversations again and again with your day ones, it's time to make some new friends. Don't get me wrong. I enjoy a good sports or rap debate as much as the next person. In fact, I love them. But I don't want those conversations to be the outer limits of what I discuss with my friends. I want friends who can talk about those subjects, but who can also recommend new books about spirituality, history, or success. Who can put me on the new restaurants that I should try, or send me links to interesting articles. Who can talk to me about what's happening in politics just as easily as they can what's happening in hip-hop. When you are constantly around the same old people who are experiencing the same old things and having the same old discussions about it, you will stagnate. They say insanity is doing the same thing over and over while expecting different results. So don't you think it's insane to expect to be further along in life if you're still acting and thinking the same way that you always have? Change is the basis of growth, and growth is the basis of life. So if you stay immobile in your ways and refuse to grow, you're going to get left behind. It's that simple. Instead of smoking a blunt with your grown-ass friends and arguing who won the Jay-Z and Nas battle for the 500th time, have a more challenging conversation. If you need inspiration, take a look at how Jay and Nas themselves are moving in middle age. I'm sure they're aware of who beat who in the latest rap battle, but they're more focused on investing in companies and expanding their business portfolios. They want to create financial legacies that are going to support their children and their children's children. That's another reason why I still love sitting in my old room and leafing through those double XLs and the Source magazines from back in the day. I get inspired reading about what Dr. Dre was doing in 2001 or revisiting a feature on Jay-Z from 2003. As hot as those guys were in that era, they'd still barely scratched the surface of what they'd eventually become. And almost 20 years later, we still don't know what heights they're ultimately going to reach. That's because they keep evolving. Those guys were never satisfied staying in the same spot, even a coveted one. They have always been committed to pushing themselves and reaching even greater heights. Muhammad Ali once said, "The man who views the world at 50 the same as he did at 20 has wasted 30 years of his life." Well, unfortunately, I can pull up to any proverbial tree in Monk's Corner, park bench in New York City, or corner in any hood USA and find too many people who have pissed those years away. It truly saddens me to see people in their 40s and even 50s trying to live the same way they did in their 20s and 30s. They're still bitching over who put in how much for the weed or who drank more than their fair share of the Henny. They're still wearing jeans and t-shirts when they hit the clubs. They swear they've still got it, but to everyone else, it's plain to see they're washed. I am not the same man I was 35 years ago, and I hope that 5 years and 10 years from now, I'll be a better man, a more mature man, a wiser man, a more humble man, and a more spirited man to serve the good of my people and the good of humanity. The Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. I'm not saying you have to stop hanging out with your friends in middle age, but have age-appropriate fun. If the person I just described sounds like you, please leave the clubs alone. That's for kids. Remember when you used to be out in your 20s and you'd see those old men lurking near the bar? How you and your boys used to laugh at them? Well, that's likely many of you now. You all have become the old men in the club, which is never a good look. When you're in your 40s and 50s, your job isn't to be out with the 20 and 30-year-olds all night. Your job is to be dropping gems on them during business hours. Your job is to be sharing your experiences, both good and bad, with them so that hopefully they can avoid some of the pitfalls that tripped you up. Your job is to show it's possible to evolve without losing touch with your roots. If you are in your teens, 20s, or even 30s, understand that your job is to shut the hell up and to listen when an OG tries to share some gems with you. Don't make the mistake of thinking just because you're cooler than them that you're also wiser, that you somehow know everything already. We get it. You're wearing the right clothes, listening to the right music, using the right apps for this era, all that good stuff, but you're still in the infancy of your evolution. Instead of rolling your eyes at an OG because he's wearing dad sneakers or he's a little chubby around the middle, listen to what he's got to say. Never forget that every 50-year-old was 20 once. Every single one. No one was born old, except for maybe Morgan Freeman and Betty White. They were young and fly once, too. Probably flyer than you are right now. They've been through so many things you haven't experienced yet. Let them guide you if they're willing. I've heard it said, smart people learn from their own mistakes. Wise people learn from the mistakes of others. It's easier than you think to be wise. Just listen to the elders when they want to share with you. Don't squander it by thinking you already know it all. Give yourself the credit you deserve for being stupid and then soak up every last drop of game that's being shared with you. Stay open to who you work with. One area I constantly see people fail to demonstrate the necessary evolution is in the workplace. I can't tell you how many times I've seen folks bring in their small-minded attitudes they've grown up with to their jobs and then be surprised when their careers fail to take off. Sorry, but in this day and age, there aren't any industries or careers where you can get ahead if you're afraid of or uncomfortable around people who you think are different from you. Specifically, I'm talking about attitudes toward people of the opposite sex, other races, and those with different sexual orientations than you. I say that as someone who was once guilty of having many of the closed-minded attitudes I'm going to warn you about. You can't come from a more unenlightened background than I did. 90s hip-hop was great, but one of his failings was promoting a lot of casual misogyny and homophobia. I grew up nodding my head when Snoop said, "Bitches ain't shit but hoes and tricks," or "It ain't no fun if the homies can't have none." Just as I rapped along, when Sadat X rhymed, "I can freak, fly, flow, fuck up a faggot. Don't understand their ways, I ain't down with gays." It's not an excuse, but growing up, I thought those attitudes were normal. Especially the homophobia. I lived under the impression that I didn't know any gay people. In retrospect, I knew plenty, but the environment at Monk's Corner was oppressive enough that the gay folk there didn't feel comfortable coming out. The first openly gay person I met was a dude I call HJ, who gave me a job in the promotions department at Z93 Jams. Initially, I was a little concerned about what people would think if they saw me around him. The job, however, required us to spend hours together setting up tents for promotional events, and in a short time, we developed a friendship. As soon as we started having real conversations, one of the first things I asked was how he found men to have sex with. Remember, in my naive mind, he was the only gay guy in South Carolina. "Oh, that's easy. I just pay for it," he told me. "You'd be surprised who will have sex with me for money. I offer $150 for head and $250 for penetration, and there are always takers." Even after befriending HJ, I was still a little concerned about the perception of being around gay guys when I joined Wendy's show in 2006, which was an issue because Wendy was a magnet for gays. When I showed up on the scene, a lot of those dudes started hitting on me hard. Instead of having fun with it, I'd get uptight and try to act tough. I'd always pull out that Chris Tucker line and Friday on them. I ain't with that gay shit. Even though a lot of straight guys spend their lives making uninvited advances toward women, getting hit on by a gay dude is somehow a traumatic experience for them. I remember one day I was walking down the street past a bunch of gay dudes when one of them called out, "Ooh, Charlamagne's got a fat ass." I didn't know how to reply, so I just kept walking. That really pissed him off. And one of the dudes started moving toward me while shouting, you're not going to just walk past us like that. Don't act like you don't see us. I can't lie. I was a little shook. So I stopped, turned around, and said, "Okay, thank you. I appreciate the compliment." After that, they left me alone. As I walked away, I had to remind myself, that's every day for women. That's what women have to put up with from men since they were teenagers. So why do we as men get so bent out of shape when the shoe is on the other foot? I actually feel homophobic men aren't afraid of gay men. They're actually afraid of their own karma. They're worried that a man is going to treat them the way they've treated women all these years. In the end, being around so many gay people, both men and women, was one of the best parts of working with Wendy. Outside of the friendships I made, it also helped me shed that casual homophobia that I'd grown up with. If I hadn't been exposed to so many gay folks through our show, I'd probably still be uptight around gay dudes or saying pause every other sentence. For those unfamiliar, pause and no homo are basically the homophobic version of "that's what she said." You're supposed to declare pause and no homo after anything that could remotely be considered gay. And I mean anything. If a guy says, "let's play ball," he has to say pause after it. I can't lie. I've cracked up at a few pauses in my time. I even wrote pause under a picture where Dr. Oz was trying to kiss me on Instagram. But after a while, it just gets childish. Guys don't know when to quit. Some people have a very hard time accepting this. The other day, I was talking to an up-and-coming comedian backstage at a TV show, and out of nowhere, he told me, "Damn, there's a lot of gay people working here. I ain't with all this faggot shit." And this guy's from New York, too, just to show that it's not a small-town problem. I decided to have a convo with him. "So you mean to tell me if a gay man saw something in you and wanted to invest in a business you may have, you wouldn't want to do business with him because he's gay?" I asked. "Well, I might take the money," the guy conceded, "but I still wouldn't really mess with him like that." "I don't get it," I replied. "Someone believes in you to the point that they're willing to put money behind you, but you wouldn't want to mess with them because of who they sleep with?" "It's not just gay men," he protested. "It's also liars, thieves, murderers. I don't kick it with anyone that the Bible says is sinning. I won't get too close to them." "How does two people being attracted to each other even remotely equal murder?" I asked before adding, "And to be clear, we've all sinned according to the Bible. I've had premarital sex, eaten pork, wore blended fabrics, ate shellfish, but you're ready to overlook those sins, aren't you? In case you thought you were going to heaven in a polyester suit, according to Leviticus 19:19, keep my decrees. Do not wear clothing woven of two kinds of material." The guy didn't really have an answer for that. How could he? I had to tell him peace and then get on my way because I've got very little time for people like that. Those who only like to cite the Bible when it's convenient to their argument. Folks like that are a joke to me. I especially get a kick out of dudes who are chronic cheaters and who have 5 kids by 5 different women, but still think that they have some sort of moral authority over gay people. You're going to judge 2 men who are raising a child together and showering him or her with love and affection every single day when you can't even be bothered with taking care of your own kids? It's insane. Whether it's the comedian I was just describing or so many other people I know, a lot of folks out here are unwittingly holding themselves back by being biased toward people they perceive as being different from them. You may think you know the Bible or know what God wants, but the truth is, you don't know nada. It's not up to you to give the universe ultimatums like, "I only mess with this sort of person," or "I won't have anything to do with that sort of person." When you start making declarations like that, you're setting yourself up to fail. All you can do in this life is hope that the universe brings positive people into your life. Whether they're gay or straight is irrelevant. And if you're closed off to those blessings, best believe they're going to make their way to someone else who's operating with an open heart, an open mind, an open butthole. Hey, a little gay humor never hurt anyone. Working with women. Another way I see a lot of men block potential blessings is by having trouble accepting women in positions of authority. They can meet a woman in a professional setting but still view her as a sexual object first and foremost. Doesn't matter how old the woman is or how senior her position, the first thing that crosses their mind is, would I fuck her? That might sound crude, but it's the truth. As most men will tell you if they're being honest. For a lot of dudes, the only women they treat with the proper respect are their grandmothers, mothers, and daughters. Everyone else is judged on their fuckability. Even Oprah and Michelle Obama. Not too long ago, I was on the red carpet with some of my friends at MTV's Video Music Awards in Los Angeles. Every time we saw a major male star, we'd salute them with respect. Oh my God, there's Will Smith. You know how many times he's topped the box office? Or, look, it's Justin Timberlake. He's still killing it. But when we saw Katy Perry, the respect went out the window. All the comments became, yo, that bitch Katy Perry is fine as a motherfucker. Or, yo, her breasts are big as shit. Katy Perry is a megastar. Someone who has sold millions of albums worldwide, but all anyone wanted to talk about was her body. I try not to fall into that trap. I don't see female coworkers as sexual objects. I see them as colleagues because that's what they are. Now, I won't lie. If they happen to have a fat ass, that will be duly noted. But only after I've evaluated what I think of them as a person and a coworker first. For a lot of guys, however, working under a strong woman feels like an injustice. I remember one of my mentors, we'll call him Richie, who gave me so much good advice, used to get upset when I worked for Wendy. Especially when I would tell him how Wendy would put me in my place sometimes during shows. Stop working with that bitch, he'd tell me. Why are you working for a goddamn woman? I'm working for her because she's giving me an incredible opportunity, I had to tell him. She's teaching me how to be a better on-air personality. Yes, she was being tough on me, but if a man had treated me the same way, it would have just been seen as him giving me good training. Hell, Richie was tough on me himself. It wasn't a problem when he would get me in line or push me to do better, so why should it be a problem when Wendy would challenge me in the same way? I could never understand that. Personally, I love working with and for women. I like to call them the original CEOs since they've been getting men together since the beginning of time. Thea Mitchum, our coach as I call her, is my current boss at Power 105.1, and she's an incredibly smart, savvy, and strong African-American woman. Getting to work under her has been such a boost to my career. I remember one time I was in the studio and Thea brought in Chris Kelly, RIP, who was the program director at WGCI in Chicago, and Bailey Coleman, who was the program director at B100.7 in Milwaukee. It was three female African-American women holding down important positions in major markets. It was dope to see. I just wish we could see that sort of representation in more industries. Supporting women is important to me because of how hard my mother worked without getting the advancement she deserved. My mother was an English teacher for 35-plus years, yet she recently told me she never made more than 30 grand a year. How can that be? All the kids she worked with, all the young minds she helped mold over three decades, and she still never made more than 30 grand? I can't imagine that a male teacher would have had to work that long for that little. Collectively, we've got to do more to support all women, not just our immediate family members. I've got two daughters, and I don't want them entering a workforce where they're going to have to do more just to earn less. My eldest isn't even 9 years old yet, and already she's very articulate about what she wants to accomplish in her life. To think that she'd have to overcome extra barriers to reach those goals is unacceptable to me. We don't accept that possibility for our sons, so why is it acceptable for our daughters? Working with the white man. One of the things I didn't like about the five percenters back when I used to study their lessons is they believed that all white people are the devil. I can't believe that any entire race or nation of people is inherently evil. Now, I can accept that a good 60 to 70%, okay, maybe 80% of white people might actually fit that description. But to put all of them under that banner is a bit of a stretch. Despite growing up in a country controlled by some of those white devils, I don't have a prejudice bone in my body. I deal with people on the basis of good and evil, period. If you're a good person, then I rock with you. If you're an evil person, then fuck you. Yet despite my straightforward way of evaluating people, I still find myself slipping into the us versus them mentality. It's hard not to. When you work with a lot of white people, no matter how friendly they act, no matter how nice they seem, no matter how many times they ask you what you thought of the last episode of Empire, I often can't help but feel there's just a touch, even just a light touch, that barely leaves a fingerprint of prejudice in their decision-making process. In light of the racial history of this country, it's hard to see it any other way. For example, let's look at the battle I had to wage over the title of this very book. For years, My plan had been to call it, I don't give a fuck and neither should you. That was the title of the proposal when I was shopping for a deal. And when the publisher bought the project, they seemed to love the title. But the closer we got to the press date, suddenly my publisher, my editor, and my book agents, all white folks, didn't want fuck in the title anymore. Why? Well, the book won't be carried in a lot of stores with that title, was their argument. Meanwhile, a quick Google search on my part revealed books have already been published with that word in the title. Books like Fuck Yes, A Guide to the Happy Acceptance of Everything, Fuck the Navy, Fuck the System, The Unpleasant Truth About a Lot of Things, or The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. Evidently, there's a fairly rich tradition of books dropping the F-bomb on their covers. I couldn't help but assume the reason it was an issue for me lay in my skin tone. When someone with my melanin count uses that word, it's immediately seen as offensive. In the end, they showed me their true issue was that books with fuck in the title don't get great placement in the stores and most don't sell well. I felt that was a legitimate concern and decided to let go of the battle in order to win the larger war. And to be fair, it ended up being a great note from the publisher and helped me refocus on the core of the book, which is the concept of black privilege. Still, that one little fight, that one minor entanglement, offers a window into the larger struggle black folks have to endure every day, often within their own minds. I've done well for myself, but I still can't get out of my head when it comes to race. I'll give another example. I was standing in line with my family for the Despicable Me ride at Disney World. One of the ways they entertain you while you wait, and man, you've got to wait at Disney World, is with a big screen TV that shows the crowd. Every once in a while, they'll have the camera zoom in on one section, and then the minions will pop up and say, "Ew, what's that smell? This section stinks." The type of joke that's designed to get a laugh from a 5-year-old. Well, they did that to our section, and I got bent out of shape. "They're only stopping on us because we're black," I hissed to my wife. "This is bullshit." "You do realize we're not the only people on that screen right now," she shot back. "There are like 20 other families with us. Relax, baby." She was right, of course. But it was still troubling just how quickly my mind went there. Another example, I recently pulled up to the airport in Charleston with my wife and kids after spending the holiday visiting my peoples. We were driving in a black Denali. Just as we started to unload at departures, another identical white Denali pulled up in front of us and parked. A white guy jumped out and started unloading his bags while his family got out. A black security guard walked over, passed the white family, and zeroed in on me. "Hey, you can't park here, buddy," he told me. "Gotta move." I couldn't believe it. "Why you ain't tell that to the white family?" I asked. "He's doing the same thing as me, same truck too, but you just walk right past him." The security guy thought for a second, then looked at me and said, "You're right. My bad." I was happy that guy was honest enough with himself that he could see how he had been conditioned to just give the white guy a pass. But most folks can't be that honest. When I see situations like that all the time, how can race not always be in the back of my mind? While I accept the reality of prejudice, I won't surrender to it. As soon as I start thinking about prejudice, I immediately tell myself to get over it. It's not that I'm in denial about racial realities, just the opposite. I know that if I give them too much credence, they will become a crutch for me to lean on when times get tough. I might slip up and let myself think, man, these white devils are at it again. No matter how I get, they're always going to be ready to take me down. Once I start thinking like that, I have an excuse not to win. But as the great Hove once said, I will not lose. Instead of getting frustrated with white devils waiting for me at every level,